Okay, we'll start where we left off last time. We got almost through the first chapter of the first dwelling place. First dwelling places. The last question of the first chapter is number 171 on your questions. And it says, Teresa says, prayer and reflection is how we enter the castle. And she'll talk about what she means by this reflection later on when we get to the four dwelling places. Because she's got a whole thing, a book called Prayer of Reflection that Jesus taught her. And she talks about it in great detail in her Way of Perfection, the other book she wrote, from chapters 26 through 29. And there's also a brochure that ICS Publications has. It comes in a pack of 25 for $4. On the whole prayer of reflection, but it's out of print right now. It's out of stock. If it comes back in stock, I'll try to order one.
I got that home because I give it to my newcomer group, and what I do is I can duplicate them on my machine.
Okay.
They're not as great, but I mean they're at least they're okay.
It's supposed to be a big help, you know, because she kind of synopsizes it in this little brochure thing, but she covers it in like four or five chapters in the Way of Perfection, and. So anyway, that's when she says prayer and reflection, she's really talking about that prayer of reflection that she goes into great detail on in the Way of Perfection. But she said those are how we enter the castle. You can't enter the castle. You can't look at your soul without getting into prayer and reflecting on God and stuff like this. But also she says there are a great many differences in the way one may be in the castle. So each one of us goes into the castle according to our own background, nature, the relationship we have with God and everything else. So all those things affect the way we are in the castle. She also says a great many people have no clue what lies within the castle. And that's true. You talk to a lot of people and you say, well, what is your soul like? You know, they say, well, it's this thing that sits inside my body. You know, they really have no clue what the soul really is. And it's sad because a lot of them have been to church all for a long time. They might have gone to Catholic school, but nobody ever really teaches them what the soul is and what it's like and what's going on in the soul. You know, Jesus says in the Gospel of John that the Trinity dwells within our soul, but they don't understand what that even means. Yeah.
How accountable are people like that? Who, I mean, might have had training, or I don't know, as kids maybe or something, and not even in the Catholic faith, but and just don't know. I mean, like they honestly don't know. But still, and yes, Father said this morning, we don't judge.
Right.
But we can't judge.
Right.
But I mean, how can they be accountable if they really don't get an idea of their soul or anything about that?
That's
I don't
know. Well, it's really sad, you know, and we hear a lot that for the past 50 years, there's been such poor catechesis, especially for adults. You know, that's one of the reasons why we started this discussion group.
Yeah.
You know, because there are so many adults that really don't have the foundations they need. And so we're using this opportunity for this group to explore different saints' books and scripture and everything else to try to, you know, make up for that 50 years of...
Yeah, each generation is farther away because they're farther away from the nuns.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah.
But, you know, if you listen, there are always things that tell you inside of you.
Yeah.
That, you know, it might be... But there... People have to... I mean, I can't believe that they don't hear some things if it's only you need to look. You need to.
Yeah.
God gives them another opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Even without Sister Mary Elizabeth.
Yeah. Well, he's always calling you. He's always, God's always calling you to himself. And he gives you opportunities one way or the other to respond. But not everybody hears the call and not everybody responds. And as she talks about that in here, too, how God is always calling us, but we got to listen. And, you know, we don't always listen. We're so wrapped up in the world, we don't hear him.
And when we were young, we were hearing it every day. Now they don't hear it.
Listen, the nuns that I had, they would beat you with a stick.
Right.
And it left. There are a lot of people that were turned away
by that.
By the nuns.
Oh, yeah, I didn't have
you
ever
know,
have
we never had that experience.
Never
we loved our nuns.
Me too.
You know, yeah. We thought they were great. They played basketball with us and everything else.
We loved them.
We loved
but still,
them. Yeah.
I, in high school, I mean, we had Mother Eleanor, and she always reminded me of Julius Caesar. She had that
Mother
marble
Eleanor.
Face, and she would rattle off the Latin. And I wasn't afraid of her, but... the hands out with the ruler in high school.
Yeah, no, I never got any, ever, once.
Well, I went to Jesuit High School, so we had the priests and brothers teaching us,
like
you
that.
Know. And they were pretty strict, you know, in discipline and stuff. We had a guy that came to class without shaving one day.
Oh.
And the teacher was our little Latin teacher. He was a little short, fat little guy. And he said, if you come in here tomorrow without shaving, I'm going to dry shave you. And the guy didn't believe him. So he didn't shave the next day. He took him and he dry shaved him right there in the class.
Boy, he'd be in prison today, though.
He would.
Doing that.
Yeah. So, you know, they were pretty strict. I'm sure they're not the same way anymore.
No.
But anyway, they kind of picked up where the nuns left off, you know.
Well, my brother went to St. John's High School in D.C., and there were a lot of homeless people, you know, around. And one day, the boys went out and got a homeless person, brought him in and set him in front of the class. I think it was the Latin class. And, of course, the Jesuits, well, they weren't Jesuits. They were Christian brothers, I think.
Yeah.
And they were horrified. But the boys got a good laugh out of it.
Yeah. We used to do all kind of stuff in high school in our class.
You survived, right? All this traumatic stuff.
We were terrible. We had a teacher that was a graduate of West Point. He taught algebra, and he was a very, very nice guy. But he couldn't hold discipline in class. You know, he expected everybody to just do what he said, like they do in the army. You know, he walked like he was in the army and everything. And so around Easter time, one of the guys brought a whole box of baby chickens and turn them loose in the class and they're running all over. The poor guy just gave up. He went down to the principal's office. He said, I can't deal with these kids.
But that's tame compared to what they have to put up with now.
I know.
Yeah. You know?
But anyway, Teresa says the prayer reflection is how we enter the castle. So we have to learn how to pray and learn that this prayer reflection is going to be very important for us as we go further into the book. But most people have no clue what the castle's like, and you know, and how do you find God, who's at the center, and that's the whole point of this book. She says regarding prayer that a prayer in which a person is not aware of whom he is speaking to, what he is asking, who it is who is asking, and of whom, I do not call prayer, however much the lips move. So, you know, you can't just move your lips. You have to actually know who you're talking to. And she talks about prayer, you know, in other works as being a conversation. It's a conversation with the one who loves you infinitely. And it has to be frequent. You don't do it just once a month or once a week or something. You know, it's something you do on a regular basis. And when she gets into this prayer of reflection, the whole concept is bringing Christ present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very important.
I can remember the nuns in first grade teaching us to practice the presence of God.
Yeah.
We didn't have that.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you remember what order?
School Sisters of Notre Dame. They were next to the Jesuits.
Yeah.
Well, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
But they lost it. They went out.
Oh.
Yeah. But that idea of prayer being a conversation with God is very important. Because you're speaking to somebody when you're praying. You should know who you're speaking to or why, you know. You can speak to the saints, too. You ask them to help you. But your prayer is to God. And that idea of knowing who it is you're talking to when you're praying is really important. And if you're just moving your lips and your mind is somewhere else, and she says you're not really praying.
But you don't have to move your lips to pray.
You don't have to move your lips to pray, right. In fact, in contemplative prayer, you don't even use words, you know? And so given this, how would you define prayer in a way that Teresa would find acceptable? What is an essential characteristic of prayer? There are probably several. What would you say, how would you define prayer?
It's connecting your mind and your heart to God. But, you know, that doesn't bar distractions.
No, it doesn't. In fact, she talks about that in when she gets when we get to the fourth dwelling place, about how you don't pay attention to distractions, really. You kind of don't let them distract you.
Yeah, but you can be praying and all of a sudden realize, you know, you may not realize as you drift off, and
yeah.
then you realize, and then you come back.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it. I was going to say on that vein, you know, it's like a loving relationship with God.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's ongoing, because relationships don't come and go, like with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
They're on your mind subconsciously, like people come to your mind during the day.
Yeah.
So it should be that way with God.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the best friend,
mm-hmm.
and he's always with us, and it's like just doing everything. It's living in his presence.
Right.
Prayer is living in his presence.
One thing that kind of struck me as I was reading through this book is that, you know, she's discovering all these things that were hindering her in her growth and her prayer. She went through a lot of struggles. She went through a lot of period when she was going through a lot of distractions and everything like that. And everybody else was trying to tell her how she should pray the standard way, you know, the beginners and proficient and stuff, and going through vocal prayer, meditative prayer, and then contemplation and all. And those things were driving her crazy. You know, because she just didn't, they just didn't resonate with her, you know. And since her time, we've had other people do a lot of spiritual writing. She talks a lot about doing God's will. Well, we just went through St. Francis talking about doing God's will, and he was a kind of a contemporary of hers. But we also have De Caussade talking about the the sacramentality of the present moment, you know, doing God's will, whatever he sends to you, that's his will. And then we have the Brother Lawrence for the resurrection, the practice of the presence of God. And so he's saying the same thing she was saying, basically. So we've had these other people, so we don't have to struggle the same way she did in learning through these things, because we have her testimony to begin with, you know, her experiences. But then we also have De Caussade and Brother Lawrence and the St. Francis and the rest of them that can also teach us and give us like a shortcut way to get to where we have to go. Instead of whacking our way through the weeds, we find a clear path, you know, that's already been plowed for us, and which is a real advantage for us because we don't have to go through all those struggles that they went through.
So we have no excuse.
We don't have any excuse. That's right. You're absolutely right.
Well, you get a lot from reading the Sister Faustina.
Right.
Her conversations with God.
Right.
Oh, you know, you can learn a lot from that.
Sure.
There's the book He and I. And
yeah.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
That's a good book.
I can't remember. I think it was the lady that wrote it, and
yeah,
she spoke to Jesus, and then the thought immediately comes back, and then it was a comment. And I used to try that, and it really, I always like it works. It's like you say something, and you can. It's really.
Yeah,
it's
I've got
an old
that book.
Book.
It's really
that's
good.
An
yeah.
old, He and I.
Uh-huh.
He and I think. Yeah. That's,
yeah. It's really good.
That was a good book.
So how well are there any other ways you would define prayer in a way that Teresa would find acceptable?
I said it was a desire for union with God, because too often when we pray, we're constantly asking for things that we want, you know?
Yeah.
I have a hard time asking for anything. So, you know, I think if we... But put yourself in the moment and just try to unite yourself to God.
Mm.
He'll tell you what you need to do and what he desires for you.
Right.
And you could say everything we do is a prayer. Work is a prayer.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah. Everything is a prayer. We offer it up to Jesus.
That's right.
That's so consoling, because the smallest little thing, he doesn't need big mouth, all the saints, a little way. It's the little things.
And why are those things prayer? What makes them prayer?
Because of communication with God.
Right.
Awesome.
Because your mind's on him. That's what he wants. He wants you to be thinking about him all the time. Because so the more you relate to him, the easier it is to love him. Because he really wants you to love him. And he wants you to grow in love. You know, when you first meet your spouse, when you're first dating, you kind of, hey, he's pretty cute or she's pretty cute, you know, and stuff like this. But eventually you really love the person.
Yeah.
And you want to be with that person all the time. And that's what God wants from us. You know, we first find out about him. You know, the nuns teach you or somebody teaches you, hey, there's a God, you know, and stuff like this. But then he really wants you to love him. And she tells you what love of God consists of as we get further in.
And you just get to know him. To know him is to love him.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a song like
that,
too.
That's remember? You want to sing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a song for almost everything, right?
Yeah.
So you can do that. But those are definitions of ways of thinking about prayer that Teresa would find acceptable, because your mind is on God while you're praying, and those kind of things. So those are the essential characteristics. Mm. Mary Beth said a little while ago that she has a hard time asking for things from God in prayer. Because she doesn't want to seem selfish, you know. Should we ask for things from God?
Oh, yes. He wants to give us everything. I have a dear friend, one of my closest friends in Long Island, just worked the rectory, and I used to go in and talk to her. And she, God bless Virginia, she has this feeling like she's not worthy of anything. And I said, none of us are worthy. Who deserves all this? And then she says, like, I'm afraid to ask for things. Mm-hmm. I go, well, if you don't ask him, who are you going to ask? We can't do anything ourselves. But, right.
And you're a child dependent on God.
That's right.
Right.
So. Yeah, so he's our father, right?
So he should give us everything.
Yeah. And he wants that dependence. Uh-huh. Right? Yeah. That's what he wants. But things are hard to get over. I mean, I got things. You know, that's it. But the expression, the more he gives you, and the more the more he wants to give you. He wants to he's infinite. And he wants to just keep giving and giving. But we have to thank him.
But why does he want you to ask him for what you need?
To show up to, well, because our dependence, we're dependent.
We're going to show our dependence on him. Yeah. Because he's our father. He's our heavenly father.
See, I have no problem asking for things for all the people, even poor people I see walking down the street. But I've never... Well, I don't, because I feel like he will take care of me. I don't have to ask. He knows what I need.
What you need, yeah.
So I don't have to ask.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
If you look at the prayer, the fiat of the Eternal Father.
Yeah, you're right.
I think I gave you those little prayer cards, you know.
Yep.
And he says, I know your needs, but I really would appreciate it if you would come to me and ask me anyway.
Yeah.
Just to acknowledge that he's our father and that he is the source of all of our good, and he's all powerful. He can do anything. And so even though he already knows what we need, he would like us to ask just because it acknowledges that relationship. You know, because if you're a little child, you know, when you have children, they come to you all the time, don't they? Don't they come to you all the time asking you for stuff? Hey, can I have a up this, can I have a candy, can I have, you know, this, can I have more ice cream, you know, I've got a Bobo on my hand, could you fix it, you know, they just have that dependency.
Can I have the car keys?
Can I have the car keys?
That's the last one. Can I have
more? Yeah. But all those things are show our dependence on God the way our own children show their dependence on us.
Yeah.
You know, they do come and ask for things. And then it's up to us to decide, should I give it or not? And God does the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, we might go to him and say, gee, I'd love to have $1 million. Well, is he going to give you $1 million? If he thinks you're going to use it properly, he might. Mm-hmm. You know, he might let you have a winning ticket or something. But for the most part, that would not be it. He wants that relationship, though. He wants you to... he talks about things you need, not just things you want. And he says, I know your needs. Tell me what your needs are. And so part of that is understanding what our needs are. A lot of people don't understand what their needs are. you know, because they're so wrapped up in the world, they don't really understand what their real needs are. Their need is God. Their need is to grow spiritually, because at the end of the at the end of time of their life, when they're standing before God in judgment, He's not going to say, how many contracts did you sign, or, you know, how many football games did you win, or, you know, any of that stuff, you know. He's going to say, do I know you? Mm. You remember that passage in the Gospels where Jesus talks about the last judgment, and people are there, and God's, the Father says, I don't know you. Mm. That's got to be the most horrible thing to hear, you know. Oh my gosh, I don't know you. And you, so you said, well, how does God know us? What makes Him know you? He finds Jesus inside of you. He finds your...
And I read someplace that when He looks at us when we die, He's going to see how much of that resemblance to Jesus is in us. I mean, you can just picture the saints like, wow. Well, yeah. The Blessed Mother, she was practically divinized, you know. But
How much are you imitating Jesus in your life? Our Blessed Mother, so, you know, I'd hate to hear Him say, I don't know you. That's got to be
then
terrible.
It's too late.
It's too late then.
I get that feeling.
Yeah, it's too late then.
And then the older you get, you go, ooh, I got to really speed it up, you know.
Right.
That's why He's got to intervene soon.
Yeah. He's got to do something.
Soon.
So then we get into chapter 2. And chapter 2 is interesting because she is very concerned about people not understanding what it means for a soul to be in a state of mortal sin. And so she begins chapter 2 trying to get us to understand the effects of that. And at the end of toward the end of the first paragraph in chapter 2, she says, see, nothing helps such a soul. They're incapable of enjoying His majesty. Nothing helps such a soul. And as a result, all the good works it might do while in mortal sin are fruitless for the attainment of glory. So since these works do not proceed from that principle, which is God, who is the cause of our virtue, being really virtue, and are separated from Him, they cannot be pleasing in His sight. Since, after all, the intention of anyone who commits a mortal sin is to please the devil, who is darkness itself, not God, the poor soul becomes darkness itself. So that's a terrible, you know, state to be in when you think about what that's like. That's really terrible. But when you're committing mortal sin, your intention is to please the devil, because you're succumbing to him. You know?
So you have to have that intention.
That's why that was a good homily.
That was the homily this morning.
Yeah.
Why don't they teach that to people?
This is
I think they're afraid they'll excuse themselves too easily.
Yeah. I like his homilies.
I do too.
He makes you think.
Oh yeah. It's like a retreat.
And you can see his faith.
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh, he's deep. I told him, I said, you remind me of Bishop Sheen. I said, I don't know, you're too young. He says, I love Bishop Sheen. I said, your sermons are like on his level.
Yeah.
I mean, he goes into it.
Yeah.
He goes into it.
Yeah, but he always tries to make you think, which is really good. You know?
Yeah.
But that's really important.
Intention.
People don't understand what being a mortal sin is, because you're setting yourself up to go to hell. And I think one of the problems is that people don't understand what hell is. They just think it's another place.
They do.
They don't really understand. Mm. You know, there was a priest that was, I think I might have mentioned it before. There's a priest that was doing sidewalk ministry in New York, or some place where they have a lot of, you know, a lot of street walkers and all this kind of stuff. And he was talking to this lady who was a streetwalker. I'm going to mute that. She was a streetwalker, and he was trying to convince her to leave that life and go do something else. And he says, "Don't you want to go to heaven? She says, no, it's boring there. I want to go to hell where all my friends are so we can party all the time.
So Alinsky on Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, they just did that yesterday.
That?
And that's what he said. He wanted to go to hell for the same reason she did.
Oh. Yeah.
I had forgotten that.
Yeah.
I hope he enjoys
that's what they think.
Yeah. I think what people don't understand is that in hell, there is no love.
No.
It's a total absence of love. Because God's not there, and God is love, right? So you've separated yourself completely from God, and God is love. So when you separate yourself completely from God, you separate yourself completely from love. And so when you go to hell, you cannot love anybody. You can't even love yourself. And nobody else can love you. So you spend the rest of eternity with an absolute, complete absence of love. Now, she talks a lot about the beauty of God. If you have the absence of God, you have the absence of beauty. And so when the saints have been shown visions of hell, like the Fatima children and St. Faustina and others, they always say how horrible people look when they're in hell because they lose all their beauty. All the beauty that God wanted to give them, they've lost. And so that when people say that I want to go to hell, think about what they're really saying. I want to live an eternity without any love of any kind. I can't love myself. I can't love anybody else. And nobody can love me. Total absence of love.
But they don't really know what they're saying.
Yeah.
They're like a rebellious teenager. They don't know.
Right.
So I don't know.
So in that last moment, we have to decide that God works it all out. He does.
Maybe if you see God, you know, then you might have to change your heart.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's why it's so important to pray for people, you know.
Faustina talks about that a lot, that last moment.
I pray every day for people who either have died or are about to die, and who, without God's mercy, would otherwise go to hell.
Right.
And so I offer the Mass for them, you know. But I always ask that God gives them the opportunity to experience His love. Because the Blessed Mother told us, I forget which apparition it was, might have been Fatima, that people don't convert. Oh, it's in Medjugorje. That people don't convert because they haven't experienced God's love. And so I ask God to let them experience His love so they can then choose
That's
His love.
That's what they need. And I think so many people don't see that or have that. And I'm thinking, you hear about these great interventions. I want to say, why doesn't God do that for everybody?
Well, maybe they're an example, you know, and people. But we learn from the example of other people. You know, this experience is the best teacher, but other people's experience is the best teacher. So you don't have to go through it yourself, you know. But
you know, in this world, what we see as evil, the world sees as good.
Yeah.
I mean, look at all these Hollywood people.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they're so totally wrapped up in the world.
Yeah.
They don't have an interior life.
Well, yes, and people see them as, oh, the ultimate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't understand. God doesn't care if you're a judge or a peasant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And isn't it coincidental? I mean, sin has repercussions, even in the natural order. Things are not right. I mean, you look at the snowfall in California. They're showing the pictures, like 146 feet of snow, and they're predicting two more storms. Like, oh, look, it's in your face. You can't get out of your house. And they need gigantic machines. They can't even use the ones the homes have anymore.
I
mean, it's catastrophic. And nobody, you got to get the connection.
Yeah.
You know?
They must be, though. It's just the news isn't telling us.
So God showed Teresa what a soul in mortal sin is like. And she says, when she saw this, she said, if this were understood, it would be impossible to sin. Even though a soul would have to undergo the greatest trials imaginable in order to flee the occasions, the occasions that would lead it to mortal sin. Since committing a mortal sin requires a certain level of understanding, of the seriousness of the act and the intent to commit the act, what does a person not understand that would lead them to commit a mortal sin?
Well, they don't understand what it means to go against God. They don't understand hell.
They don't understand that you're ruining your relationship with God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very important.
Maybe they don't understand sin.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think so.
They have no idea.
It's just mistakes.
Yeah.
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 But I'm still stuck on the statement up above that says the person's intention is to please the devil. I don't know if I agree with that. I think the person's intention is to please themselves.
Right.
Because of a disordered understanding of what we really are. We're the creatures, not the creator.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, I've always thought the root of all sin is pride, right? You think that what you want is the most important thing, and you should be able to do whatever you want. I mean, when I do wrong, it's not because I'm trying to please the devil. It's because I'm thinking that what I want is the most important thing.
And we're making ourselves God.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think she means it the way you're saying it.
Interpreting
it. I think what she says is the intention is to please the devil. I don't think the person has in their mind,
no,
oh, the devil is there, I want to please him. Mm. Their intention is to do what he's calling them to do, to make him happy. That's what I think she's getting at here. Okay? Because he's the tempter. And one of the things we learned in philosophy was that whenever the devil is going to tempt you to do something, he never presents it as an evil or a bad. There's always a good element attached to it. If a bank robber is going to go in to rob a bank, the intention is not to steal other people's money or to hurt them in the process. The intention is to get this money and be happy with all the money you're going to be able to get.
And they won't miss it that much.
That's right.
Don't look at this right, but do you really think that every time you commit a sin is because the devil is asking you to commit that sin, or is it because we're weak and we have...
Well, the world or the flesh or the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it could be either one. I think our own weakness could lead us into sin.
Yeah.
But I think it's almost always a temptation of some sort that we're gonna act on through our own weakness.
I think you give up some of your own culpability if you say it's the devil tempting me every time. I think we need to take ownership of the bad choices that we make and admit that I put myself first. My own pride made me do whatever it was that I did.
Well, can't you say that we can do two things? We can look at it as if it's a temptation from the devil, because he can put thoughts in our head, but we are responsible because we give in.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it's like we can have two things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes, but nothing is ever anybody's fault. Haven't you seen that?
Right.
In the world, nothing is ever anybody's fault.
Right.
That's right.
If you shoot me because I stole something, it's your fault, not mine.
Right.
Because I stole it. I think you look at those things and you think, where are people's minds?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think people think, I'm a good person, therefore the church is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There was... I read it this morning, maybe it was in the New Advent. It's totally disturbed me about, I don't know if he was a priest or a bishop, saying that we should bless same-sex marriages.
Oh, yeah, that's what's going on right now.
A lot of
them
are doing that now, in Germany especially, yeah.
How can this
Germany,
be?
Yeah. The Senate.
Right.
How can they think
I think
that?
It's the same thing. They think, they're caught up in it. And they think, I'm a good person, therefore the church has to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So they look in the Bible, they look in history, and they say, oh yeah, they didn't really mean that.
It's like God is love. It's yes. like when my kids, the catechism changed. If yeah. God is love, and they didn't learn sin and the commandments, if God is love, then everything is love, then and love is okay.
Yeah.
The whole world's flower children.
Yeah. Yeah. With this right kind of love and the wrong kind of love.
Yeah.
But that's what we're living in. But God chose us to live at this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to stay.
Maybe we have to be the ones to correct it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which they basically ignore me, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Teresa says that she was not surprised by things done by a person in mortal sin, by what was not done. Says there is nothing while we are living that deserves this name evil except mortal sin, for such sin carries in its wake everlasting evils. Because as long as you're in mortal sin, the effect is eternal, it's everlasting. Having been given the grace to understand this, Teresa says she received two blessings. First, an intense fear of offending God. Second, a mirror for humility, in which she saw that none of our good deeds has its principle from ourselves, but from God, because God is the source of all good. Without this help, we can do nothing. What other saint are you aware of who also had this same first blessing, this intense fear of offending God?
Well, Mary, number one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's right. I thought St. Maria Goretti, she had the choice.
There are lots of saints.
Yeah, there are a lot of saints.
I thought of the martyrs who had choices,
right.
And all of them.
Sure.
But,
Padre Pio is a good example, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was always praying to his spiritual directors to pray for his death. Because he said, I'm so weak as a human, I'm afraid I'm going to do something to offend God. Mm-hmm. They would write back and say, there's no way we're going to pray for that. So stop asking. We're not going to do that. We're going to die whenever God wants you to die, you know. So, but he was so afraid of his human nature, you know.
St. Rita, when her husband was killed by that other faction in the family, and the sons went out, and they wanted to kill the murderer of her husband, and she prayed to God, take my sons, and they both died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had a fear of
Yeah, get them before they can do anything, yeah. So there are a lot of saints that understood this fear of offending God, and she talks about that a lot through this book, that we should be obedient to God and have the fear of God, you know, always before us. The fear, meaning not we're afraid of God because we want to be in union with Him, but the fear of offending Him is what the real fear of God is. And the second is a mirror for humility. What scripture from the Gospels confirms this second blessing, this idea of humility?
I cheated, and I went on my little jitterbug phone, and I wrote down some words. No, I went on Google, and I put the question in. I said, this isn't right, because I'm looking through the Bible. It didn't come right away. And what came up was, I am the vine, you are the branches, and you can't
the
do anything apart
right.
from me.
Yeah.
That's right.
That was my choice
cheating.
As well.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing?
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
Well, I think when I think of humility and our true understanding of it, I also think about the fact that we can never merit anything. I don't care what you do here on earth. You know, getting
right.
into heaven is a grace and a blessing from God. It's nothing
yeah.
that you can merit.
That's
so
right.
yes, we're asked to do good works. We're asked to pray. We're asked to, you know, do what we're supposed to do. But in the end, it's all God.
It's all God,
it's all
yeah.
God. Every good thought. I didn't realize that until my Carmelite nun wrote. She says, no. All good thoughts. I thought it was my thoughts. That wasn't too long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another example of this mirror of humility is the Magnificat in the Gospel of Luke. And it really bothers me that the new translation, you know, the prayer is called the Magnificat. The Magnificat.
Mm-hmm.
And the first line is, my soul magnifies the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the name of the prayer comes
right,
from.
Yeah.
They changed it.
What did they change it to?
Yeah, the first line is not, my soul magnifies the Lord anymore.
But where did they change it? I mean...
When?
When?
I mean, where?
After Vatican II.
Oh, way back then.
Well, see, yeah. Nobody has paid attention to
it. If you look at the, open your Bible and take
or
a look at it.
Or open our Magnificats. It must be in there.
And at the Carmelites, we put the Magnificat in with the liturgy of the hours.
It is. It is. It's part of the liturgy of the hours.
You're not obliged.
So what does it
say the new one?
It says, my soul proclaims the greatness.
That's how it is in the Magnificat, the monthly thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's proclaims instead of glorifies.
Right.
So why did they change it? They
part
must
of this
have thought it was more
they did.
Conformed to
but
the
But they don't understand what she's really saying. When people were afraid that she was saying that she makes God greater.
Herself.
She makes God bigger. And she doesn't. What does the magnifying glass do?
Magnifies
it makes the thing that you're looking for or looking at easier to find or to see. She's like a magnifying glass or a microscope. Okay? She's not saying I'm magnifying God. She's saying I am making him easier to find. I'm going to bring you to him. I'm going to hold your hand and walk you down the path to go there. That's why Teresa earlier says, imitate Mary. You know, Jesus in the gospel says, imitate me. Teresa says, imitate Mary. Why? Because she's the perfect model for us to follow, to find God. Her job is to bring us to him. You know?
Yeah.
And so when I saw that change in the Magnificat, it just irritated the blue Jesus out of me, you know? I mean, it's just, it's just so irritating.
Wow.
My soul magnifies the Lord. That's what she said.
So people thought that she was magnifying herself by saying, my soul.
Yeah.
I'm.
She said, I'm making God bigger.
Yeah.
I'm making God bigger. And it's not. It's just not the
case. Well, that's how we get off in tangents and heresies.
Yeah.
Overthink it.
But they're always, they do try to help us, but it doesn't help us, you know?
Yeah.
But she's the perfect model of humility, and so we can imitate her.
Hmm.
Yeah, and recognize that, you know, everything comes from God. Hmm. But she's also a perfect model in adhering to whatever God sends to her, whatever he asks her to do.
Right.
You know, so be it done to me according to your word, or fiat. Say 271. Teresa says we always hear about what a good thing prayer is, and our constitutions oblige us to spend so many hours in prayer. Now, the constitutions are the Carmelite constitutions that govern what they do. Yet only what we ourselves can do in prayer is explained to us. Little is explained about what the Lord does in a soul. I mean about the supernatural. It is so little understood by mortals, even though many walk through it. So here Teresa begins to discuss the essential idea that our journey through the castle is all about the relationship between the soul and God. Relationship is what is the purpose of everything. When you have prayed or thought about prayer, to what extent did or does your relationship with God inform your prayer? Is prayer for you a one-way communication of either petition or thanksgiving? Does speak, Lord, your servant is listening, enter into your prayer. So she says, even in their constitutions, it talks about what you do in prayer, but not what the Lord does as part of prayer. So when you think about prayer itself, how does your relationship with God inform that?
The only thought I got for that question was, like, your relationship with God is the basis for your prayer. It's the essence of prayer. It colors how you pray, how you think about God. If you treat him as a friend, you're going to be more open with him. And what else? you love him more, your prayer is going to be more loving. It's all, it's relationship, your relationship with God.
Yeah.
It's your prayer life.
Right. And so the point there is that your relationship with God is different from your neighbor's relationship with God.
Hmm.
We all have our own individual relationship with God. Hmm. And that's something we have to realize, that we're not all in the same relationship with God as everybody else. We're individuals, and he treats us as individuals. And so whatever that relationship happens to be at this point in time, hmm, is going to influence and affect the way you pray or how you pray.
Yeah. I'm thinking of St. Therese. Like, she had such a loving relationship with her father that it just flowed, that went into the relationship with God the Father. Mm-hmm. So maybe right. It's like your childhood experience. Well, everything comes from you, your childhood to a degree. Maybe
yeah.
The way you're related to the people in your life
mm-hmm.
relates to God to
yeah.
some degree when you pray.
Yeah. I had a good friend that that was, you know, getting into prayer. He was in the Army and Special Forces and everything, and he was talking about growing in prayer and everything like that, and he said it was hard to relate to God the Father for him, because he was always looking at Jesus,
mm-hmm.
talking about Jesus, mm-hmm. you know, reading about Jesus in the Gospels and everything else, and it was hard to relate to God. He didn't know how to approach God the Father. And I think people have trouble with that to some extent, although we do have the Our Father prayer and all.
Mm-hmm.
But people also have the same problem with the Holy Spirit. Because when you look at the God the Father, we can kind of imagine a father figure.
Mm.
You look at the book of Revelation, and it talks about the sitting on the throne. You know, we can kind of picture him. We can picture Jesus. It's hard to picture the Holy Spirit. He's a bird, you know. He's the dove.
You know? And I think that's why we ignored him as a church for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's hard to picture God the Father if you have not had a good father.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's because you don't even know what a father is.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
And, you know, and we take so much from our personal experience and put it into our spiritual life if mm-hmm. you relate to God on a person basis.
Yeah.
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 That's right.
Right.
That's right. And so if we had a problem with our earth father, could we approach God as kind of a foster child? So we have a foster father now who's a very good foster father. Could that help somebody?
But if you haven't been a foster child, you might not be able to.
Right.
Yeah.
Or foster child.
But would that be a way somebody could overcome that problem and relate to God the Father on a personal level? That would be a positive thing.
I think God must have to do it for them.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, God does everything for us, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm thinking, too, like these poor children that are born into maybe just one parent,
right.
into poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Must be so difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know, to
sure.
see God as a loving father when
mm-hmm.
they, you know, have right. nothing. It must be so hard.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Muslims deny God as father.
Yeah, they never talk about that relationship.
That's what they really hate about us.
I've never understood what they think of as, who do they think God is?
Very just God.
The judge.
Why?
Power.
My daughter and I talked about this. Why is it so bad for you to show a picture of Muhammad? Why is that a bad thing in their culture?
I don't know.
But you know they kill people for that.
Right, yeah.
Because they so respect him, maybe?
I don't know. But then my daughter said, she said, now there is a picture of God the Father in the Basilica. People do not have pictures of God the Father in their home. Think about it.
Yeah.
We have pictures of Jesus, Mary, different saints, but we do not have
God. Isn't that odd?
I mean, did you ever stop to think about that?
Yeah, never. They even thought about that.
What?
They don't print them.
We don't have pictures of God the Father in our home.
Well, we sometimes have the Trinity, don't we?
Do we?
Well, we have the, if you have the,
Jesus.
If you have the prayer card of the Fiat of the Eternal Father, there's a picture of him on that.
Well, there is in my rosary book of crowning of the Blessed Mother, but not, you know, not the way we have other.
Mm-hmm. That's probably because Jesus took on a human nature.
Yeah.
So we could relate to him as a human person.
And then Jesus said, if you see me, you've seen the Father.
See that?
But that's taken it a step.
Yeah.
I don't want to criticize.
But he always says that. So when you pray to Jesus, you're praying to the Father, are you not?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're always praying to the Trinity, right?
Yeah.
You can't
well,
separate them.
It's hard for, you know.
Yeah. It'd be helpful, I would think, yeah, as a children to see God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit on a prayer card.
Well, there are some. There are
really?
Some prayer
yeah.
cards.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
What is the prayer Jesus gave us?
Our
Father.
Father.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Without a picture.
I mean think about it.
Yeah.
This is our Father, you know?
I wonder, are there any apparitions to saints with God the Father?
No, I don't believe so.
Huh. Yeah, the lady, it was an approved apparition, the lady who received it's the only approved apparition of God the Father, the lady who got the prayer of the Fiat to Eternal Father. That story is the only. If you don't have it, I've got it. I
leave. Prayer, but I don't remember the picture.
Yeah.
Because I think you just gave us a little reprint.
It's a card, yeah. Oh. It's a card, yeah.
Yeah.
But that whole apparition was of God the Father.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the only church-approved apparition of God the Father. If you don't have it, let me know, and I'll send you the book. But in there, he talks about how much he loves us and how much he wants us to, you know, love him back and everything.
You know, I read Salvation is from the Jews.
Right.
In the back, where the man, I think, who's writing it, is overcome with a feeling of love, and then he has to... And this is true.
Roy Shulman, yeah.
And I read that over and over again sometimes, and I think to be that privileged, to have that feeling.
Wow. And that's what I mean, how God intervened in his life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only way he ever would have converted in his state.
That's right.
Right.
So there's hope.
Did you get the Catholic Herald this week? Okay, do you still have it?
Yep.
The Arlington Herald, I think.
Arlington Herald, yeah.
Yeah, I might have a letter. I don't know.
In there is a story about a lady who was giving a talk in March. She was a Muslim and converted to Catholicism.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story.
Okay.
The talk is next week at St. Joseph's in the retreat for the women.
Uh-huh. It's a beautiful story. She talks about how she was always trying to get this relationship with Allah. And it wasn't happening, and then she actually became Catholic, she found the relationship through Christ, you know, and it's just a beautiful thing to read, you know, it's just really amazing. And so if you still have it, go back and read that story about how she got to where she is. It's really interesting to read. Hey, Teresa begins to 281. Teresa begins to further explain what the inside of the castle looks like. So she's going to start walking us through the castle now. The rooms are not linear, but we should always keep our attention focused on the center, the room where Jesus is, because that's the goal. That's where we're trying to get to. Surrounding this central room are many other rooms, just like on all the other levels. We should always think of the things of the soul as plentiful, spacious, and large. says the soul is capable of much more than we can imagine. And the light of Jesus emanating from this center illuminates the entire castle. This light can shine through the outer wall of the castle and be seen by others. So Jesus wants us to get our castle clean so that he can shine through us to reach others and draw others to him because of what they see in us. This light can shine through the outer wall. Jesus tells us in the Gospels that you are the light of the world. Jesus uses us to bring his light to others. In what ways have you understood this and tried to bring his light to others? I think all of us, in one way or the other, have tried to bring his light to somebody else in some way.
And we're always told to be a witness to Christ.
Be a witness, teach CCD, you know.
And loving your neighbor. I don't want to blow. You know, if you say something, it's like, oh, look what I did. But it's on each side of me. One lady had cancer, and she's recuperating from that. Then she had a stroke. And she's coming along, but she doesn't go to the mailbox anymore. She's learning to re-walk and talk. The other lady, I knew them both, moved in maybe a year or two ago. Tiny little grandma. She's like a Barbie doll. She's so tiny. She rides her mower. She's all around. I go, here, there she comes again. And we chat, and I know her. And I met her a while ago, and she doesn't open up too much, not personal. And she goes, I have cancer. And I said, I'll pray for you. And I sent her a mass card. I don't think she's Catholic, but she mentioned like her pastor or somebody. But so now I alternate, because it's easy. I'm right in the middle. So, you know, if I bake, I can. So that's, it's like, I think where the occasion arises, then you do something. Everybody, you know, has different lifestyles. I don't think you have to go out. At this age, I don't want to go out looking for stuff. It's in front of me. You know what I mean? So that's.
Sure. That's. So all of us have different opportunities to try to bring his light to other people. And I think it's really, you know, God is going to present those opportunities to us. And then, because, you know, nobody comes to you by accident, right? People come to you because God sent them into your life, either for a temporary period of time or for a long time or whatever. But they're there because God put you together. And so, you know, one's going to teach the other. You're going to both help somebody else. You know, there's always a reason why you're there, but it's always to share God's love with somebody, and or to receive God's love from somebody. And the goal is to get everybody to heaven that we possibly can. Sometimes it's just to wake up somebody. Somebody who's been kind of just drifting, you wake them up and say, hey, knock, knock. You know, there's something, there's a reason for your life, and you're kind of missing out on it, so wake up and try to help somebody that way. But there are all kind of ways that we can bring his light to other people.
I think even listening to people. You have friends, I got friends that call, and one of them, God bless her, I just hold the phone, and my arm gets up. And she talks so fast. I can't relate or hear. But I say, well, I'm listening, Lord. And she appreciates. Like, I think it's simple. That thing just come.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be complicated.
I have to tell you about my neighbor that wanted to sell his house, and he couldn't sell it so many times. And Jim had said, I put a hex on you because I don't want you to move. And so the guy was not very friendly after that. So this year when he was selling his house, I said, I got to end this. So I walked over and I said, I'm saying a novena. He was used to be Catholic, a novena to St. Joseph. So 2 days later, he sold his house. The neighbor was so angry at me. They didn't speak at all except to be mad, because in the meantime, they decided they didn't want to sell the house. Then another neighbor took them in. He had gotten cancer, and she had cancer, too. So then she died at the neighbor's house, like a couple of weeks later. I mean, he was furious
That's
at me
horrible.
Always because I prayed.
Sold his house.
Yeah, but he didn't want to, and he blamed me. He thought my prayer was that good.
But that that's another example of nothing's my fault.
You got to move your neighborhood, Mary. Come on over this.
Oh, man. I'm sorry. So what happened? You had to move?
Well, he lived with that other neighbor until I'm sure. And then he just moved now to another area because he couldn't get the house back. They wouldn't.
Yeah.
They paid the earnest money.
Yeah.
And they had actually paid earnest money on a house sight unseen in Raleigh or someplace.
Oh,
they didn't
wow.
get their money back for that either.
Oh, wow.
But that's, in the meantime, the lady that died was a good Irish Catholic. They were very hateful to the church, so I prayed for them the whole time they lived there.
Oh, yes.
And I'm hoping, like Faustina said, that at the last minute, because I never got any insurance.
Oh, wow.
Okay,
Teresa wants us to explore the castle. It's very important for any soul that practices prayer, whether little or much, not to hold itself back and stay in one corner. So she wants us to kind of move through this castle kind of quick. She remembers how long it took her. It took her years to figure out all this stuff. She doesn't want us to spend all that time. She wants us to get to the center as quick as we can.
This was like 6 years before she died, right?
5 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She wrote this. And she was learning all the time because there are things that she wrote in the book of her life in the way of perfection that she had not learned yet that she has in this book. Mm. It's the last book she had, she wrote. It says, very important for any soul that practices prayer with little or much not to hold itself back and stay in one corner. Let it walk through these dwelling places which are up above, down below, and to the sides, since God has given it such great dignity. Don't force it to stay a long time in one room alone. Oh, but if it is in the room of self-knowledge, how necessary this room is, see that you understand me, even for those the Lord has brought into the very dwelling place where he abides. For never, however exalted the soul may be, is anything else fitting for it, nor could it be even were the soul to so desire. Humility is always at work. Without it, everything goes wrong. So here, for the first time, Teresa emphasizes the importance of a relationship between self-knowledge and humility, like two sides of the same coin. So important that you must keep coming back to these rooms, even if Jesus has brought you into the seventh dwelling place where he resides. So at every level, in every one of these dwelling places, you'll always find the room of self-knowledge and humility. Because as you progress through the soul, you learn more about yourself, so you're always going into that room of self-knowledge and humility to grow in both of those virtues. Why do you think these two rooms are so important? What is the relationship between these two rooms, and how would these two rooms influence what you might experience in other rooms?
I just thought you can't have one without the other. I'm thinking of the song
humility.
Love and Marriage, right?
Yeah, right.
Self-knowledge and humility.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it takes humility to look into yourself.
To get
self-knowledge.
Because
we know we're not perfect, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to see things we don't like.
Yeah.
Right.
And
just have two or three daughters. They'll tell you who you are.
Yeah, they call humility the queen of the virtues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the relationship? All right. How would these true fortune might experience other rooms?
I just said you have to, it helps you keep things in perspective, like I said before, to understand your true place and station in life. So if you're not humble, if you don't take the time to, you know, look at yourself honestly, then you might be not looking at things as they really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people want to see themselves as they would like to be,
right,
not necessarily as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where humility comes in, and also where self-knowledge comes in. Because you got to be humble enough to look at yourself, you know, honestly, And then once you look at yourself, you say, where do I stand? It doesn't mean you beat yourself up. And that's another thing that people get confused with. They think humility is beating yourself up all the time, and it's not. It doesn't mean you're beating yourself up. It just means you're looking at yourself. And when you look at the virtue of humility and self-knowledge and all, you're never comparing yourself to other people. You're only comparing yourself to Christ and the Blessed Mother. They're your models. They're the models for all the saints.
I think that's what we don't do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my always go-to is give me a kind, loving, and merciful heart. Because I'm very critical of people. And I think that helps. There's a pamphlet in the back of the church. I noticed, I picked it up Sunday, I think, on confession.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And there, I think, oh, really? Is this wrong? You know, and it's, a lot of it is looking inside yourself and seeing the kind of person you are.
Yeah. I went to confession as Father Gould once. And it's a good thing I didn't scream out loud. I must have mentioned I was judgmental or something. He says, you know what? He says, I find those New Yorkers, they can be like that. I said, gee, maybe the lady ahead of me was from New York. I couldn't, I didn't scream out loud.
See, and that hurts my pride that he knows exactly who I am.
Oh, well, that doesn't bother me. They can tell by your voice if they
know. I know, and now they keep the light on.
Yeah.
Wear a mask.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
So these two rooms are really very important. Because it's hard to get to Jesus in the center of your soul if you have delusions about yourself. And if you think you deserve to be there. And that's where humility comes in. She mentions later on in one of the chapters that some people think they've progressed far enough that they now deserve to be in the seventh mansion with Christ, you know. And so you have this self-delusion that, oh, I'm such a good person. How can he possibly refuse to bring me there, you know? People really think that way, you know. It's like the Hollywood mentality, you know. I'm so famous. Why wouldn't anybody not want to love me, you know? And so that whole self-knowledge and humility thing is always at work as you walk through the castle. It's always at work as you're progressing in your prayer. And so you always have to look at yourself honestly and compare yourself to Jesus. You know, he says, imitate me. So it's hard to imitate him if you're not looking at him and comparing yourself to him. How can you imitate him unless you compare yourself to him? Well, how did he treat other people? Do you treat other people the same way? You know, was he always kind? Was he forgiving? You know, he's on the cross. Say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, how can you not forgive other people when he does that? So you're always comparing yourself to him. You look at the Blessed Mother's humility. She stands before Christ on the cross. And that's my son, you know. But she had to accept that because he had prepared her for it, and she knew it was necessary. But think of how a mother would feel watching their child go through something like that. You know, it's just so you're always comparing yourself to them, never to other people. If you compare yourself to other people, then you say, "Well, geez, they're not nearly as advanced as I am, or they're so far advanced, I'll never catch up," you know, or you get envious, or you get jealous, or, you know, you get prideful, and you lose all the benefits of what you've accomplished so far, you know.
You know, I never understood the word deserve. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I remember a person saying, well, she bought this finer car because she deserved it.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, I don't understand deserve.
No, that's a funny...
It's an advertising ploy to get you to buy it.
Yeah. Well, they have some kind of shampoo or makeup or something that they advertise it that way. So you deserve it. You know.
Deserve.
I forget
everything
what it is.
We hear it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might think a lot of yourself to come out with that word, deserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They teach us.
You know, or maybe it's just a word that she used.
I don't know. It's just...
It's an odd... Yeah.
It's just because what... We really don't deserve anything.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, a kid might deserve a spanking.
So we are...
That's in a different context.
We are 10 minutes over.
Oh.
And so we're going to quit now.
Gosh.
We'll pick up at 291 next time.
So we're
and keep on going. I apologize. Earlier, I said something I shouldn't have said. I said irritates the blue.
What'd you say?
Yeah, I didn't want to repeat it.
I don't want to repeat it.
Oh, I'm so deaf.
I was talking about the Magnificat. And I just says irritates the blue, whatever, out of me that they changed that thing, and I shouldn't have said that word.
I can't remember.
That's good.
You're safe with us because we don't remember much.
That's good.
No, it's scary, isn't it?
But,
it's really scary.
Oh, it is.
I just kind of blurted it out.
Remember things 50, back 50. You can't remember what you had for breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, it's happening.
Yes.
It happens.
Well, I apologize.
Because
I just kind of blurted it out, and I shouldn't have.
Right, so we have no clue.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad. Okay. Anybody have any final thoughts before we end for the day? Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
Okay.
Thanks.
Have a good week.
Have a nice week.
Okay. Okay. I went to Staples and I was looking for a wireless printer to hook up with this. They didn't have many. And I went on this phone to look what to do. It was so confusing. They had some guy giving examples of, I didn't even understand the words.
Yeah.
So I said, forget it. Forget it. I need it. My Carmelites are doing stuff like this at St. John of the Cross. And all of the lady did mimeography.